within the framework of the marriage contract. Okay. All of this is very weird to us, right?
It's very strange. Why should anybody get married? The children will be legitimate. There'll be property auction. So why should he get in trouble?
Good question.
Tie himself up to a marriage?
Very good question. Why should he do that? Unless he wanted to inherit his wife, for example. If he married a rich wife, then it pays to...
he can't inherit her.
No.
It doesn't say
Malchus. I think he says it's permissible. He's giving you, in fact, he's giving you some advice about how to arrange your life.
But why does he use the word heter?
What?
Why does he use the heter harachi? Should have said the mutter.
It's mutter, right?
But heter usually means something excessive.
This whole thing is obviously very strange. And by the time of the Shulchan Aruch, this has disappeared from the halacha. I'm running a little bit short of time. Let's...
Who looked at page 8?
Excuse me?
Who looked at page 8?
Page 8 is a Tshuva Doran, in which he also mentions very explicitly that the existence of Pilakshim was common practice. Okay? And certainly in Spain at the time of the
law. You had to wait 3 months too for a Kalegish.
Also questionable. That's an interesting question. If we have time, we'll come to it. The Radvaz which I don't think we have time for tonight. I should go through it. If we have time at the end, we will go through it. Gives a rather complete summary of all of the positions on the subject up to his time. And the Shulchan Aruch writes, Ein Ha'isha, that's my page 411, I guess it is. Right. Yeah. My page 11. Ein Ha'isha nechshevet eshet ish, ela al yedei kedushin shenitkadsha kara'ud. A woman is only considered married if there has been a proper marriage. Aval im ba'a v'haderech znot shelo l'shen kedushin, casual sex doesn't constitute kedushin. Ein o klum. Even if he had sex for the purposes of marriage, but in private, to the contrary, he cannot keep her as his common law wife. The Vadai, the Rama adds, the Boshahi Militvo, because since she's only a common law wife, and embarrassed by the fact that she's not properly married, she's going to be ashamed to go to the mikvah, and therefore, so the Rama is adding an auxiliary reason. It's not because the sex itself is prohibited, but rather because she's a nid. Aval im yached elav isha betovelet elav, if a man has a mistress and she goes to the mikvah regularly. Yesh omim shemutal. Some say that this is permissible. Vohu pilegesh hamura b'Torah. This is the Raiva of Tzat Mefarshim, but the Tzat Mefarshim includes the Ramban and the Rashba and the Tzedol Aderech. Vyesh omim sha'asur v'lokin al zem yishun lo teik desha. And some say that it's prohibited, and this is the prohibition of lo teik desha. And he leaves the matter open, and of course our custom, certainly since the time of the Shulchan Aruch, has been to accept the Rambam's position to prohibit the common law wife or the mistress, whatever you want to call it. Okay? So we have an additional puzzle here. The additional puzzle is, why did this come about? In other words, why is it that I think it's safe to say that from the time of a little bit after the Rama until the present, with the single exception of the Tshuva of Rabbi Yaakov Emden that you all remember, certainly until 30 or 40 years ago, the accepted morality of marriage and sex in Judaism is that sex is to be confined to within the marriage bond. This is certainly the traditional view, both if you just from the spirit of everything in the Gemara and the in the Dvashim, even though there's no explicit ruling against it, it's so obvious that it's understood, and it's certainly the spirit in which we've been brought up. Why was there this period, this window in Spain from the 12th century or the 13th century until the 14th or 15th century in which the idea of a mistress was allowed? Why did this happen? So we have three puzzles here. Where did the Rambam get this distinction between a melech and a hedyot? And where did the Rambam take his position of being so machmir on the one hand? On the other hand, why did the Ramban, the Rashba, and a host of others adopt such a liberal position on the issue of the permissibility of a man to have a relationship with a woman outside of marriage, to the extent of really distorting the obvious meaning of kala b'lo bracha and so on? I mean, the interpretation that the Ramban gives to it is obviously far-fetched. Now, a secondary puzzle, which is a clue to this, is why did the Gemara have so much trouble understanding what a pilegesh was? In other words, we had three opinions in the Gemara, that is, two opinions in the Tanoim. One was that it's below Bikdushin or below Ketuba, and then Rabbi Yehuda, that is with Ketuba but without Tnoi Ketuba, and then the final position of Rav in the Gemara was that it was below Kedushin or below Ketuba. The Gemara itself seems not to understand exactly what a Pilegesh is. In order to explain all of this, I'm going to now follow Epstein's description. I've xeroxed the entire chapter from Epstein's book at the end, but let's go through some of his argument, which I think is quite correct. And the first thing is to understand that marriage and the Bible and the Talmud, I think. Okay. Marriage laws in the Bible and the Talmud. Okay, so some of the chapters, like the one I xeroxed, are excellent. Overall, it's a good book, but some of the chapters, especially this one, is excellent. Okay. So, what he says is, in roughly speaking, is the following, that the Pilegesh existed as an institution in the time of the Avos. That is, if we take a look at what the legal codes were at the time of Avraham Avinu, there are many different grades of marriage. Marriage was not just simple, like, you know, there's many different grades of professor. There's a full professor, and there's an associate professor, and there's an assistant professor, and there's an instructor, and there's a lecturer, and what have you. At the time of the Avos, there were various different grades of wife. And the term Pilegesh was only one of several grades of wife that existed. Epstein distinguishes five different types of wife. For example, there was the notion of a Gvira, queen wife, principal wife.
Okay.
Sarah, Milkah. Those names can mean like a queen. Then there was a regular wife, an Isha. For example, for the queen wife, let's take a look at the Hammurabi Code, number 146 and 158. Let's first look at 158. My page 14, Code of Hammurabi, number 158. If a man, after the death of his father, be taken into the bosom of his father's chief wife, who has borne children, that man shall be driven away from his father's house. In other words, the son, apparently, was allowed to take over some of the lower grade wives and concubines, etc. For example,
Reuven.
Reuven, for example. But the principal wife, the queen wife, if the chief wife, if she actually had children, there was no possibility of a child of the father from a previous wife or from other wives to take over any of his father's lower grade wives. Okay? If we go back and take a look at if we take a look at the second grade, 128, for instance, if a man take a wife and do not draw up a contract with her, that woman is not a wife. In other words, that the definition of wife means that there's a ksur, that there has to be an actual written contract having to do with the dowry and the financial obligations and so on. Okay. So if we take a look at 137, we see that if a man set his face to put away a concubine who has borne him children, or a wife who has presented him with children, it may mean that his wife had her maidservant bearing his children, that may be a technical meaning here. If a man set his face to put away a concubine who has borne him children, or a wife who has presented him with children, they should return to that woman her dowry, and she'll give her part of field, garden, and goods, and she shall bring up her children. From the time that her children are grown up, whenever is given to her children, they should give to her a portion corresponding to that of a son, and the man of her choice may marry her. Okay? So he's saying that if there is a get, there's a certain financial obligation to the wife equivalent to a son's portion. But he distinguishes between a concubine and a wife, so that there is a notion of concubine here. Okay? If we take a look at number 184, but before we go to 124, in 137 you see that the idea that what we read was that the daughter, or that the children have to be given a portion. The notion is that even though the children of the concubine don't inherit, right, they nevertheless are required to be given gifts in lieu of an inheritance, right? Is in compliance with the accepted law of the time, which was the code of Hammurabi, which said that the children of the concubines are given gifts, but they do not share in the inheritance. In 184, if a man did not present a dowry to his daughter who was a concubine, perhaps it should say a daughter of a concubine, and do not give her to a husband, after her father dies, her brothers shall present her a dowry proportioned to the value of her father's estate, and they shall give it to her, to a husband. Okay? If we go back to number 144, if a man take a wife, and that wife give a maidservant to her husband, and cause him to have children, if that man set his face to take a concubine, they shall not countenance him. He may not take a concubine. In other words, there should be, you see, the difference between the Babylonian code and the commonly accepted code is that there was monogamy in the Babylonian code, in the sense that a man could have one chief wife and one concubine. Could have, of course, lots of servants, maid servants, and other women of a lower status. but the once the wife, chief wife, who has not borne children, gives him her wife to bear children, that maidservant becomes elevated from the status of maidservant to that of concubine. In other words, once she bears children to the husband, not an ordinary maidservant who bears children, but a maidservant who is specifically given to the husband as a substitute for the chief wife, that woman has the status of a concubine. Okay?
Now, then she is.
She is a concubine. He cannot take another concubine. Right?
He can't pick up from himself. And she cannot have any relations with someone else.
Doesn't say that. Doesn't say that. Okay.
I think we'll
okay.
All right.
Now, so we see once again. The next one says, if a man take a wife and she do not present him with children, and he set his face to take a concubine, that man may take a concubine and bring her into his house. That concubine shall not take precedence of his wife. Okay. Number 145. Right. Okay. So, to summarize, what we see here is that there is a notion of a shifcha and a notion of an amah. What's not mentioned in the code of Hammurabi is something that we do find in other codes, and we certainly find it in the Torah, and that is the notion of a shvuya, that is a woman who is captured in war, which we record in as Yifasto. So that therefore we find five types of wife, five gradations of wife with different statuses in the
what's the difference between Amah and Shivcha?
It's not 100% clear what the difference is. A Shivcha apparently is available to all for sexual purposes, not just for the master, even during the master's lifetime. And in other words, an Amah, a Shivcha is sort of a slave girl, and the other, and an Amah is a slave wife. So you have the chief wife, which would be a gvira, an ordinary wife. The distinction between the two not so clear in the Babylonian code because of their manat, because of monogamy. Then you have a concubine, and the concubine sort of
wait, that was pilegesh.
Pilegesh.
Would that be number one? Then? Number three?
No, three.
That would be number three. Then you have an ama, and then you have a shifcha. Okay.
Oh, so you're not counting.
Now I have shvuya.
So it's six.
Six.
Ama is higher.
But it's hard to get a clear distinction between shifcha and ama.
Which
so I
is
don't.
The higher one?
It's again not so clear. I would imagine that a shvuya is a higher status because she probably came from the princely caste or the upper castes of the number. All of this is also a result of these women, not just simply their status.
What was
in
Bila, for example? And Bila?
Bila was exactly the status that was raised, remembered here, namely that she was a...
Appointed by the Rachel?
She was appointed by Rachel to bear children to Yaakov. And it's interesting that she's called a Shifcha throughout until Rachel died. So in contrast to the law of Hammurabi, she becomes elevated to the status of a wife only upon the death of the...
Not as a Pilegesh.
Not as a Pilegesh. She was a Pilegesh all of the time until... She was a Pilegesh all of the time, but the Torah calls her a Shivcha. All of the time, Rachel dies, and then after Rachel dies, she becomes elevated to the status of Eishes Yaakov. So that's also interesting. In other words, we don't have to assume that the laws in Israel at the time, that is, that the laws that Yaakov followed, were exactly the same as the code of Hammurabi. Avraham Avinu, coming from that region, was presumably following more or less the code of Hammurabi, but Yaakov Avinu, who was living in Israel at the time, was more or less influenced by other codes. For example, to show, again, an interesting aside, let's take a look in the Assyrian code. Yeah.
after the woman had relations with her, was she allowed to Yaakov or not?
What?
After Ruvain had relations with
complicated. Let's take a look at 140. In the Assyrian code, my page 19.
140.
My page 19. 231 on the...
Page 231, okay.
Yeah. If the wives of a man or the daughters of a man or his women go out in the street, their heads are to be veiled. The daughters of a man with a garment or with a garment are to be veiled. As for widows, their heads with or without are to be veiled. When they go out into the street and go about, they should veil themselves. The concubine, captive woman, it's not clear what she's talking about, and the translator is having some difficulty, who apart from her mistress goes to the streets, is to be veiled. The sacred prostitute who a man is married is to be veiled in the streets. But one whom a husband is not married is to have her head uncovered, open in the streets. She is not to veil herself. The harlot is not to veil herself, her head is to be uncovered. The one who sees a veiled harlot, the Caesar, secure witnesses and bring her for the judgment of the palace. Her ornaments they shall not seize. The one who sees her shall take her garment. 50 blows shall they shall inflict on her. Bitumen they should pour on her head. But if a man sees a veiled harlot and let her go, and not bring her to the judgment of the palace, on that man they shall inflict 50 blows. The one who caused this apprehension shall take his garment, etc., etc. If a man sees a veiled maidservant and let her go, and do not seize him, do not bring her for his judgment to the palace, they shall prosecute him, and they shall convict him. His ears they shall pierce, they shall string them with a string, they shall bind them to his back. The one who causes his apprehension shall take his garments, a month of days he shall do the king's work. If a man veil his concubine, 5 or 6 of his companions he shall cause to sit down, before them he shall veil her, he shall say, she is my wife, she is his wife. But the captive woman who is not veiled in front of the man whose husband did not say she is my wife, she is not a wife. She remains a captive woman. If the man die, not having sons by his veiled wife, the sons of the captive woman shall be their sons. They shall receive a portion of the paternal estate. So notice, first of all, that the custom that we relegate as being a minor custom in the wedding, namely bedekin the kala, is actually the most ancient part of our wedding ceremony. Goes all the way back to the Assyrian times, before long before the time of Matan Torah, and Rivka, for example, is following the Assyrian code, which is that the veiling of the bride constitutes the act of marriage. So, in contrast to what the Tzedek LaDerech says, and based on the Gemara, namely that marriage consisted of only bia, that is, bringing her into the house and bia. In fact, there was a specific ceremony of marriage, the ceremony consisting of the veiling of the bride. And if a man had a captive wife, a shvuya, and he wished to elevate her to the status of full wife, then he did it precisely by veiling her in the presence of 5 or 6 of his companions.
That was the contract.
That was the contract. And the difference between these two states of the captive wife is that the children of the captive wife do not inherit in the presence of children of an ordinary wife, but only they will inherit if there are no other children. But in the case that he veils the captive wife and converts her into a full wife, then we say, okay. So what we see from all of this is contrary to both what the Rambam and the Ramban, and perhaps even the Gemara was saying, is that there were rather complicated marriage laws that existed around the time of before Matan Torah, and they had at least 5 different grades of wife, and these different grades of wife had consequences as far as inheritance was concerned. They had consequences as far as the financial obligation of the husband to the wife was concerned. They had consequences as far as the legality of sexual intercourse during the lifetime of the husband. In other words, a slave girl was just simply available to the master for sex, but she was also available to anyone else in the house for sex. And the idea that the wives below the chief wife or the principal wife, including the concubine, were part of the estate, which normally the son, or at least the chief son, would take over at the time of the death of the father. Okay? So what has happened here was that the whole notion of family was a major corporate undertaking. You had the big daddy, who was the head of this whole household, the Avram, if you like. Avram is a technical name here for the head of the household. He had his chief wife, the queen, the Sarah, of Sarai, and then perhaps various grades of concubines, slave wife, maid wife, and servant girl, all with different roles to play and different statuses as far as the law is concerned. All, and remember, the Torah tells us at a minimum the size of Avraham Avinu's household, right? No, I mean in the story of the Avos HaMelachim, right? The Torah tells us, "Vayishma Avraham ki nishba achiv, vayorech et chanichav yilidei veito, shmona asar u'shlosh meyot." So Avraham Avinu, at a minimum, had a household of 318 people.
Men.
It's not even clear that the household wasn't much larger than that, because after all, 318 equals Eliezer. Numerically, it equals Eliezer. And therefore, this is not an accident, and therefore, just as Eliezer was standing symbolically for the whole household, these 318 men may have stood symbolically for a much larger corporate existence. So that the idea of the big daddy, the queen mother, the large household, the various grades of life, was the natural form of the unit. In other words, the family unit did not consist of a nuclear family, that is a husband, a wife, and children, which, as we said, are beginning, is disappearing from the face of the earth today, but existed as you existed as part of a large corporation. It was a corporate estate.
That was a clan.
As a clan. Okay? Avram, just like Paro is a technical term, Avram was a technical term, and Sarai was a technical term. That was the name of the king. It didn't mean, it wasn't his private name, it was the king. All of Caesar, like Caesar. So that this whole family structure gradually disappeared, of course, with the transition from nomadic shepherd existence into agricultural existence, and then into commercial existence and so on. In other words, just as, say, within the last 70 or 80 years, that is from 80 years ago to about 30 or 40 years ago, the extended family disintegrated into the nuclear family, and now the nuclear family itself has disintegrated in the time of our children or grandchildren's existence. The structure of the family changed from the time of Avraham Avinu to, say, the time of the Bais Rishon, and certainly to the time of Bais Shem. So that when the Rambam is explaining that there is no notion of Pilegesh except for HaMelech, he's actually stating a historical truth. That is, the only place where this notion of a clan leader remained was with the Melech. All of the government became centralized. Instead of having lots of separate corporations, the government became centralized in a king. There was a disappearance of the clan as a unit, or the corporation as a unit. There was only a nuclear family left. And therefore, what happened was that all of these different grades of wives disappeared. But by the time of the Gemara, by the time of the end of Bais Sheni, there's no two types of wife. You don't have four different grades of wife. The idea that you're going to have a slave girl as your wife is inconceivable. Either she's a slave and you're not allowed to have sexual relations with her, or she's your wife, in which case you're allowed to have sexual relations with her. Therefore, according to the Gemara, Yud of Amar and Ivriya is simply a change of status, right? You took this girl on as a maid girl with the understanding that you might eventually want to marry her, but you were certainly not allowed to use her as a sex object until you converted her from a into yud. But of course, that was certainly not the original meaning of yud. The original meaning of yud, when the notion of a slave wife actually existed as a form of wife, was simply appointing this particular slave girl to be this other member of the household's sexual partner. In other words, sexual partnership existed within the framework of the corporate existence, and yud originally meant something completely different from what it meant in the time of the Gemara. So the Gemara, of course, has gone... There are no two different grades of son. Either you're a full-fledged son, or you're not a son at all. In the case of a Kohen, you may have some problem of a cholol. In the case of a mamzer, you may have some problem of whether the mamzer himself is allowed to marry. But basically, all wives are equal, all sons are equal. The Gemara has reached a stage in which, first of all, the large clan family has broken down completely. Secondly, there's a complete democratization, and the rights of women have changed to the state that there's no such thing as a chief wife, an ordinary wife, a concubine, a captive. Either you're the wife or you're not a wife. The problems with what was going on with the Pilega Shebegiva, or the various Pilagshim that I mentioned in Shoftim, Epstein deals with by saying that they are probably remnants of an entirely different type of marriage altogether. I haven't been able to check his sources for this, but he claims that also there was a form of marriage in which the woman remained with her father's household, what he calls a metronymic marriage. But I have not been able to verify his hypotheses here, so you can just check them out or read and see if you find his argument convincing. I find his argument relatively convincing, but since I don't have independent proof of it, I'll just leave you to read it. So basically his theme is that the notion of Pilegesh as it existed in ancient times disappeared by the time of the Gemara. And that's why the Gemara doesn't know at all what a Pilegesh is and has some trouble figuring it out. On the other hand, the concept of Pilegesh was taken over by the Greeks and then by the Romans, and transformed. In Greek society, Pilegesh basically meant the captive wife who had the status of a maidservant. In Roman law, that notion didn't exist at all, but in Roman law, the Pilegesh, in fact, became the concubine. That is, the woman with whom the man was having a regular sexual relationship completely outside of marriage. Doesn't differ from a mistress. A mistress or a concubine. It was a mistress. In other words, in Roman times, okay? So that therefore, it's quite possible that Rav, who says that Pilegesh is below Kiddushin uvelo Ketuvah, is already influenced not by the form of Pilegesh which existed in the time of the Avot, but rather by the form of Roman Greek Hellenic concubine, which meant nothing more than a mistress. Okay, and the mistress meant a man who wanted to have a regular relationship with a woman but did not want to take any financial obligations, like a widower, for example, who did not want to have a new crop of children who would be his heirs. He wanted to protect his children. Or later on, when celibacy was required by the church, then all the popes and the various bishops had mistresses because it was against the law to marry them. Sure, I mean, this was a regularly known... Okay. So that therefore, by the time that the Spanish Jewish community comes on the scene with the Ramban, the model of the ancient Pilegesh certainly doesn't exist. What did exist was the Roman version of this, and all of the ambient society, this was a regular custom. In other words, the sexual mores in Spain at that time had as understood that a man, especially if you were a priest, you didn't have a wife, but you did have a mistress. their concubine. Therefore, the Ramban and the Rashba and the Jewish community as a whole, looking through the texts and not seeing any specific prohibition against the concubine, took the position that it's permissible, but interpreted this permissibility to apply not to the notion of Pilegesh as it existed in the time of the Avos, but to the notion of Pilegesh as it had developed in the Spanish society that they served. So I think we now understand the whole complex of what was happening here. The Rambam was basically correct. That is, he may have been wrong on a few details as to what the nature of Kiddushin was, and so on, but the fact is that the concubine as an institution died out with the conversion of the clan into the extended family, and the only place where it was retained was the king. that there were no various forms of wives, only one form of wife. A man is only allowed to have sex with his wife. And the Rambam, of course, being very machmir, was not accepted because it was beyond the capacity of the community to abide by the law that a man was only going to have sexual relations with one wife. And therefore, the more popular view was that which was accepted by the Ramban and his school. Eventually, with the advent of the Shulchan Aruch, and a little bit afterwards, the position of the Rambam won out, which I think was the traditional position. The only one person who tried to resurrect this in the 18th century was with Yaakov Emden, who was one of the takers. And, of course, looking back, one can say that there was a sudden shift in sexual behavior, and certainly in the American Jewish community, even amongst those young men and women who regarded themselves as otherwise orthodox, I would say, certainly to my recollection, in the 60s and the 70s. I'm too old to know what the young people are doing today, and I imagine with the advent of AIDS, there's a reversion to more strict morals when it comes to sex, so that there's, again, a short period of about 20 or 30 years in which Jewish practice, at least within the New York and other American communities that I'm aware of, became much more lax on the issue of sexual behavior than had been any time in the past from the time of the Ramban, say from the 13th and the 14th centuries. So that's what I have to say about Pilegesh. How much time do I have left?
As much as you want.
No, that's my usual hour and a half.